Hello, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of the Raptor Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. I'm your host, Alex Wong. I'm joined today by Sports Illustrated senior writer and author of Blood in the Garden, the flagrant history of the 1990s Knicks, which is in stores now. Chris Herring is on the line with us. Chris, how are you, man?
I'm doing really well, Alex, man. Thank you for having me on. It's fun to be on with another author. I know you just had yours come out pretty recently, too. Congratulations, buddy.
Yeah, of course. On this program, I never pass up a chance to promote my own book. So cover story in stores now. Everybody go pick
there
it
you
up.
Go.
No, Chris, I was thinking before I went on air, I don't remember last time I saw you at an arena. You must have maybe come to Toronto during the championship season, which is so long
ago
now.
I know, which is sad. I mean, I remember catching up with you. I don't even think that was the first time I met you. But yeah, it's been a while, and I certainly didn't think it would be that long before I'd be able to come back. But what a fun city. I live in Chicago, where I feel like if I had to, just based on feel and everything, I had to pick another NBA market that feels most like Chicago, I would probably say Toronto, and then Philly's probably up there too. So I'm looking forward to being able to come back. But yeah, it'll be good to see you again.
For sure. So I wanted to start off by asking you, well, congrats on the book. You know, I actually finished the book in a single day. And just to give you some context, I've been having a lot of trouble reading during the pandemic. And some of that maybe I blame on because I've been working on book projects as well. I don't know about you. Like when I'm working on a book, unless I'm doing book research and things like that, I find it really hard to dive into books on my off time. But this was a wonderful book. So it's got my full endorsement, whatever that means. Everybody should go right now as you're listening. Go look up Blood in the Garden, the flagrant history of the 90s Knicks, and pick up a copy, please. But Chris, I wanted to ask you, you've been doing a lot of book promo this week because this is a release week for you. How many interviews and events have you done? Are you keeping track?
I've got it somewhere. I haven't been counting it like one by one, but I think I've had something like 30, maybe 35 this week. But, you know, I think I stole a couple last week and kind of banked them early so that I could buy more time. I know there were 2 days this week where I looked up and it was like 6 o'clock and I hadn't had anything but like a bottle of water. But it, you know, and it's also weird too, because I live in Chicago, but I've been in New York all week. And I think it was the right decision. You know, you mentioned, first of all, thank you for everything you said about the book. But, you know, late last week, Spike Lee had gotten hold of my book. And he also read it basically in one day and called me the next day after that. We talked for hours. And he basically was like, you need to come out here to New York. Like, we want to hang out. I was like, what? So I've been to like a couple games with him and been hanging out with him. So I kind of had to be here, you know, obviously for that, but also just the promotional stuff. Some of the stuff will be TV stuff. So being out in New York makes more sense since it's obviously in a book about the Knicks and everything. But yeah, it's been quite busy, and but I'm grateful for that. I mean, it's a very good problem to have, and not even a problem at all. It's a real blessing. I've been completely overwhelmed by just people's gratitude and or not people's gratitude, but people's support. And the amount of gratitude I have for them, I don't know if you felt this way, it's really overwhelming in some ways, in a good way, to see all that support at once and just how many people make a point to buy something that you've spent that long working on. It's really a big blessing.
The support is overwhelming, and I think it's one of those things, and I don't know if you'll agree with me, is that I want to be able to convey to every single person who either tweets about the book or tells a friend about the book, like how much that is appreciated, because you know, as a book project, this is something that, you know, we work on individually and we kind of just hold on to ourselves for a year, 2 years, 3 years, however it may be. And there's like an excitement and also a nervousness when it gets shared with the rest of the world, right?
Oh, completely, completely. You, I don't know. And I mean, yours was about such a unique subject. And like, it's even just reading through it, you're like, I never knew any of this. But I don't know that anybody's really taken the time to dig through it, which is why you do a book on it. With mine, I think I was worried a little bit, but then I felt like I'd done enough work to kind of get past it. The last thing you want anybody to do who is like a diehard Knicks fan, the last thing you want is for someone to pick up the book and be like, dude, I know all this already. Like, I've heard this already. I've read this already, so you're not telling me anything I don't know. That's the last thing you want when you've spent 2.5 years on something. And so my biggest goal, there were several, but my biggest goal with this is, like, no matter what, keep pushing until you know there's enough of a value add in this book for even the most diehard fan, you know. And that was what Spike said when he called, what Spike Lee said, was that there's so much stuff in here I didn't know. And, like, I don't expect to be, you know, surprised when I read things, but there was just so much to it. And, you know, even some of the executives from the team have said that, where, like, there were just aspects of things that they didn't know, maybe from the other side of the table or a different person, about how they felt or what they were thinking or what they were going through. That makes you feel good, just because you know your time. You weren't wasting your time by putting out, like, just kind of a subpar, mediocre product that people weren't going to be impacted by. You want people to feel something when they read your book. And so it's been a really, just, again, I'm just very, very grateful that people have seemingly really enjoyed the book, and it's been completely overwhelming to see how many people have actually bought it and actually wanted to go out of their way to buy it or pre-order it or what have you.
Yeah, we're with Chris Herring, author of Blood in the Garden, The Flagrant History of the 1990s Knicks. Now, I know, Chris, I think listeners have a pretty good sense of what this book is about, but I'm wondering if you could dive a little bit more into, you know, this being a book about the 90s Knicks, where did this grand idea come from, and what did the 90s Knicks mean to you personally?
Very, very little. I didn't know anything about them. I mean, I grew up in Chicago, but I was 4 when the Knicks hired Pat Riley. So by the time he left, I was, what, 8? And, you know, it's funny because people are like, wait, well, you're from Chicago, you have to hate the Knicks, right? And I'm like, but I don't think the Bulls and the Knicks have had a single playoff series against each other since I've been of an age to actually absorb that. I think maybe the last time they played each other in a series was when I was 7. Or actually, no, I guess maybe 8 or 9. But I wasn't, I really didn't start paying attention to basketball until maybe the Bulls won their 5th title. And what I did know about it, I just kind of figured everybody gets this. Like, I figured every city gets, you know, annual parades in the summertime for winning something. So, I didn't know anything about the Knicks specifically. I didn't know about the rivalry with the Bulls. I didn't know any of their players. I'd heard of Patrick Ewing, but, like, what did that mean to me living in Chicago? So I didn't have any motivation to do the book because of that. I didn't have any animosity toward them because of where I was from. I didn't have a huge overwhelming loyalty for the Bulls because of where I was from or anything like that. So none of that played into it. And if I'm being completely honest, a literary agent approached me about doing the book. The for sure thing, you know, surefire thing with it is that all the book publishers have headquarters in New York. And so the literary agent, doing the smart thing, basically is trying to feel out the publishers to figure out what sorts of books they'd really like to see in the next couple of years. And, you know, he kind of took a survey, and several of them said they wanted a book on the 90s Knicks. The Knicks have been horrible for the last 20, 25 years. On top of that, all the book publishers happen to be, like, the people that run those publishing houses are all basically Knicks fans. So, you know, he basically was told in advance, if you can find a good writer to handle this, we would all be willing to bid on it. So he just started looking for a writer, a guy named Jonathan Abrams, who's a fantastic writer, a 2-time New York Times bestseller. He kind of threw my name to the literary agent, saying he'd be a really good person to tackle this if he's available and if he wants to do it, because he's covered the Knicks before. He's young, like, he's hungry. He does a good job of kind of covering things in a different sort of way. He'd do a good job. And so the literary agent approached me. I initially said no once or twice, but then thought about it more. And I'm young. I don't have a family. I don't have any children. And I figured maybe it would be a really good time to try to tackle something like that. But as I got into it, I got really fascinated, just because it was such a different time, and in a way that I probably couldn't even appreciate when I took on the project. People that just have started watching basketball in the last 5-10 years would not recognize what the 90s were from a basketball standpoint. It was a lot less skilled. It was a lot more physical. You had rivalries where the teams and the people actually hated each other and despised each other. The storylines were more plentiful. There was actually, like, a danger to it physically when you looked at the way they were playing. Pat Riley, the coach of those Knicks teams, was actively telling his players to go out and basically try to hurt people at times. At least Michael Jordan, you know, was kind of at the top of that list. And they were doing it as a way to kind of equalize things as far as not having the same sort of talent that the Bulls did, and realizing that, but saying, well, this is our best shot, is basically to try to level the playing field by being more physical and being so intimidating that they won't come to the basket against us. And the league really wanted to legislate that out. They did not want physicality to overcome the idea of talent and skill. So the league actively started changing the rules to try to make it so that that wouldn't be, you know, the teams wouldn't copycat what the Knicks were doing. But the Knicks were, aside from the way they played and the fact that they kind of pushed the limits as far as physicality, they were also just a fascinating team as far as, you know, a guy on their team that 4 or 5 years before he joined the team was bagging groceries at Safeway. You know, Anthony Mason was a guy that had played in multiple countries before really making it in the NBA. He was also a New York guy who'd grown up in New York City, but, you know, just an extremely complicated figure and a guy that, you know, was accused of steroids, was accused of all sorts of things off the court, and, you know, and charged and arrested for all sorts of things off the court. Charles Oakley, who obviously people in Toronto would know a little bit, but, you know, a guy that obviously was one of the more physical players of that era, maybe the most physical player of that era, but someone who, you know, his high school basketball coach made him play football so that he would actually develop more of a physicality. So that was where it came from. And then obviously Patrick Ewing, you know, the one blue chipper that they had on that roster, who was a star, if not a superstar during those years, but could never quite get it done, and dealt with a whole lot of, you know, kind of demons just before he even really made it to the pros in the form of racism. So a fascinating team, and maybe the most fascinating character of all was Pat Riley, the guy that led them, and, you know, probably burned himself out in New York within a 4-year span just because of how hard he pushed and how kind of maniacal he was behind the scenes, in a way that even I didn't really know when I first took on the project.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Pat, because he's such a prominent character throughout the book, especially in the first half. Now, you as a basketball writer who's been covering the NBA for a long time, obviously you're familiar with Pat's story, but going through this project, what were the things that you learned about Pat Riley and Pat Riley during this New York Knicks era that maybe even surprised you?
So I knew that the guy was like, didn't have, you know, his parts tied on all the way and tightened up all the way. But like, there were a lot more screws loose than I realized when I kind of dug into this, as far as just interviewing people. The stuff they would tell me, I mean, just to give the listeners an example, he was so just kind of passionate about the idea of like, you either are with my vision or you're not. You're either in what I'm talking about or you're out. And it was so visceral and so serious for him, I'll give a couple of examples, down to the fact that he had basically let go of a basketball operations staffer really early on that, you know, a pretty decent amount of people with the team liked. And so people were angry or, you know, frustrated, sad that Pat has come in. And then, you know, one of his first moves is basically let somebody go. And Pat knew that people were kind of stewing about that. So one day at practice, he just kind of brought it up unannounced. He said, okay, I know some of you guys are upset about that. Okay, so what? That's the way it is. And if you don't like it, you know, so be it. And what he said is that sometimes you got to shoot a hostage in the head and then, you know, look around and say, who the F is next, basically. And so, like, I took that person out, and if you don't like it, you can be the next one to go, and I'll shoot you as well, more or less. So he says that about being in or out. And then I think the crazier one is even more wild. The first training camp that he spent with the Knicks in 1991, he was with Dave Checketts, who was the team president of the Knicks at the time. And Dave's wife called him while he and Pat were having lunch. So he, you know, said, Pat, excuse me. But he was standing right there, so Pat could hear the conversation on the phone. Dave's wife was buying a Chevy Suburban for the family and was trying to get Dave's input on a color of the car. So she says, okay, well, I was thinking about forest green. Does that work for you, Dave? Dave says, sure, I think that's fine. Pat can hear Dave's wife on the other end of the phone, and he's like incensed that Dave would even consider signing off on the idea of a color being green. And he says, Dave, you cannot get a green Suburban. And Dave starts laughing because he's like, well, first of all, what business is this of yours? But secondly, why? What difference does it make? And he's like, green is the Celtics, Dave. And obviously Pat Riley had the, you know, the huge rivalry with the Celtics during the 80s and even in his own playing career before that. So Dave laughs more, but then Pat is completely, completely serious. So Dave asks him if he's serious. He says, I'm dead serious. So Dave tells his wife, okay, I guess we're not getting a green Suburban. What are the other colors they have? She offers up red. And, you know, Dave says, that's fine by me too. It's not okay with Pat, though, because Pat brings up immediately, that's the color the Bulls wear. Like, that's even worse than the Celtics. Like, we're playing in the Bulls right now. So, you know, he essentially tells his wife, you have to get a blue Suburban because that's the only thing Pat will be okay with. It's the only color that doesn't conflict with Pat's vision. But that's how ridiculous he was as far as, like, being all the way in or all the way out. It's like, he was going to judge the color of your car with regards to it too. Like, that's just, and like, it's one of those stories where, like, you have to ask someone, like, kind of, are you being serious? Like, did this actually happen? Because it's so ridiculous and, like, over the edge with something that fundamentally doesn't matter, but everything mattered to him. And I think it actually explains a lot about how he burned out in New York the way he did, because if he was that passionate and, you know, aggressive about everything, even the things that really fundamentally didn't matter, you're naturally going to burn yourself out, you know?
Yeah, no, there's a lot of great stories in there about Pat Riley, the way he ran the Knicks. And what was even more fascinating was kind of all the behind the scenes maneuvering for him to end up with the Miami Heat. But we'll save that because, you know, I want people to actually go pick up a copy of Blood in the Garden by Chris Herring to check out these stories. Now, being the Raptors show, I got to fulfill my obligation, Chris, of referencing the Raptors. Absolutely. At least once in this segment. So let's talk about this. This comes later in the book and we're jumping around a little bit, but there was the Charles Oakley for Marcus Camby trade that the Knicks and Raptors pulled off pretty early on during the Raptors franchise history. This was after they had already moved Damon Stoudemire to Portland. Isaiah Thomas had left the team. Glenn Grunwald had taken over as the general manager. Tell the listeners a little bit about what you learned about what went down between this trade and Charles Oakley's hesitance to come to Toronto.
Sure. So the timeline is important here because, you know, remember in 1998, the league is preparing to go into a lockout at that point. And so it's the night of the draft and the Knicks are looking at their roster. They've just gotten ousted by the Pacers. And I think the semifinals of the Eastern Conference, and you know, they just looked old. The Pacers were kind of running circles around them. They had a quicker, more athletic roster. So the Knicks are knowing they need to get younger. You know, they were the fourth or fifth oldest team in the league by that point. And all the teams that were older than them, from the Bulls, the Jazz, the Sonics, they'd all been to the finals more recently than the Knicks had. So they had to get younger. They had to get quicker, more athletic. And Oakley was a guy that just Jeff Van Gundy, the Knicks coach at the time, just adored. Partly because Van Gundy, you know, he looked at himself almost kind of like someone, like a man that doesn't find himself to be attractive enough to be with a woman that's beautiful. Like, that was almost the way he kind of talked about himself, was the idea that I'm this guy that's never played in the NBA before, and yet I get to coach Patrick Ewing and Charles Oakley, and they let me coach them. And, you know, they allow me to do that. So he felt indebted to Charles Oakley for giving him a chance to do that and not ever making a point about what Jeff's experience was as far as being a player, only being 5'9" or what have you. So anyway, Van Gundy really wants to hold on to Oakley, but the Knicks essentially make a decision to trade him because they, you know, he's one of the most valuable pieces they have. He's an enforcer. He's one of the best rebounders in the league. He's extremely physical. So the Knicks realize that he's a good bargaining chip to trade to try to get younger and to try to get more athletic. So Ernie Grunfeld, the Knicks general manager, decides to place a call to the Raptors, to Glenn Grunwald, who was the general manager of the Raptors at the time. And he basically says, what would you think? I know you guys need to, the Raptors were coming off a horrible season where they were the worst team in the NBA by far. And not just that, but they were, you know, kind of financially strapped at the time as well, because, you know, people are not filling the seats for a team that's that bad. And he basically says, look, I know you guys need kind of a locker room leader and you need someone with maturity and, you know, someone that can kind of show your young guys the way. What would you feel if we give you guys Oakley and you guys give us Marcus Camby? Because you guys obviously, you know, you need to turn the page on some of the youth you've got. obviously Cammy's wildly talented, but you know, there'd been all sorts of reports about him not being most mature. And Butch Carter, who had been the coach of the Raptors at the time, told me basically, he was like, Marcus was extremely immature. Like, I smoked up every tree, you know, north of the border. He lived in the same condo as me, yet somehow couldn't make it to practice, and would say that he got caught in traffic. It's like, I live in the same building as you, so I made it here. You could have made it to practice too. So anyway, Ernie Grunfeld wants to make this trade. And Glenn Grunwald really wants to make this trade, but Butch Carter, the Raptors coach, gets on the phone. He has a personal relationship with Ernie because they both played for the Knicks at the same time during the 1980s. And not just that, but I guess Butch Carter was telling me that Ernie Grunfeld had given him a really important book to read about the Holocaust, essentially. Ernie Grunfeld is the only player in NBA history who was the son of Holocaust survivors. So that's really important to him. He'd given Butch a really important book to read about that. So Butch Carter had always been grateful of Ernie kind of like educating him on a really important historical moment and event. So he basically had a kind of a deep friendship with him, to where he wanted to protect Ernie Grunfeld from making what he thought to be a mistake. Butch Carter was basically, even though he was the Raptors coach, he was saying to Ernie, are you sure you want to trade for Marcus Camby on a roster where like everybody's super mature and, you know, plays really hard and is like a veteran team for a guy that's this immature? And Glenn Grunwald was kind of looking at him like, why are you trying to make this trade harder for us? Like, why are you giving him an out? Basically, like, he's trying to make this trade. Let him make the trade. So somehow Ernie Grunfeld doesn't pick up that cue from a friend, even though it's on the other side of the table. He does not pick up the fact that, you know, that Butch Carter is trying to warn him not to do that. And he's like, you know, Butch, let me and Glenn handle this. We'll figure it out. But thank you. So he basically shoos Butch Carter off the phone. They finish the trade. And the minute that Glenn Grunwald and Ernie Grunfeld hung up the phone with each other, Butch Carter looked at Glenn Grunwald, again, the Raptors GM, and said, Ernie's going to get fired over this. Like, he doesn't realize it now, but like, he's making a terrible mistake. Like, he should not have let Oakley go, because Oakley fits the Knicks culture so well, and Marcus Camby does not. And it's going to end up getting him fired. And it was, you know, it's pretty good foreshadowing in that sense. You know, the idea that good foresight that Ernie did essentially get fired over that, because Marcus Camby was someone that wasn't as mature, and I would also say wasn't really as physical as Oakley. Oakley would play through everything, and Marcus Camby would get a slight blister and decide that he couldn't play for a week, 2 weeks. He'd go into a game and get winded after 5 minutes, and Jeff Van Gundy hated him essentially for half the season, and it essentially got Ernie Grunfeld fired, among other things, in the middle of that season, which then the Knicks somehow advanced to the finals anyway. It was a very strange season. Those lockout seasons are always very weird with who gets to make it to the finals in a lot of cases. But it was a very interesting sort of interplay between the fact that Grunfeld and Butch Carter knew each other, but also the fact that Butch Carter essentially kind of saw it coming that Ernie Grunfeld was going to get canned over making that move.
Yeah, we need, Chris, we need behind the scenes play-by-play like this of every major trade. And honestly, the Oakley for Camby trade is not even like a huge trade if you line it up with the other blockbusters. Like, I want the same oral history of like the Kawhi Leonard to Toronto trade with Masai on his BlackBerry. He's in Africa hanging out with Barack Obama, and you know, the Spurs are you know, actively trying to not move Kawhi to LA. So we need all this. I love this. I have to ask you one more thing about Charles Oakley. This is the one detail that stood out, and I'm sure you've been asked about it. Actually, I think I saw the No Dunks guys. Shout outs to them. Ask you about this. Charles Oakley brought this like credit card machine with him on the plane. So then if the gambling got out of hand and people were out of cash, like, he actually had a swipe machine for them. Is that right?
That's completely accurate. Charles Oakley enjoys gambling more than just about anyone you will meet. Which makes sense. He came up with Michael Jordan during those first Bulls years that Michael was there. And Oak, when he got to the Knicks, you know, continued to want to gamble. You know, he made pretty good money as one of their bigger names on the team, but would get frustrated, like you said, when some of the younger players that didn't earn as much would basically bow out and say, I'm not going to play with you guys because you guys are playing for too much money. I don't have enough. Or, you know, even if I do, I don't have enough cash. So that was kind of the frequent excuse that would be used, or the rationale that would be used. And as a result of it, what would happen is that Oakley would say, okay, fine. maybe not this time, but you're going to get in this game. And Oakley finally found a workaround in which he said, now I've got a credit card imprint machine that I've bought, you know, the old school scanners that, you know, that you could use. I guess it's not normal that people have them, but normally stores had them for charge cards and stuff like that. But once he did that, he started taxing players. And he basically said, you know, now you don't have an excuse that you don't have cash, that you can't use that as an excuse. I've taken that one off the table. Now there's a credit card imprint machine. I want you to use it, but if you use it, you're going to pay me 10% of whatever you owe, you know, for playing in the game to begin with. So, you know, if it was a $2,000 tab that somebody had, he would end up charging $2,200 instead. But just, I mean, the fact that that was how he operated, and the fact that he was going on every flight with a leather duffel bag that, you know, $50,000 cash each time, Oakley was ready to gamble. And as people north of the border have probably heard before, you know, that having a credit card machine was probably a safer way to handle it than not having enough cash, because Oakley was known to smack people, you know, quite hard if they didn't pay him, or if they didn't pay him on time. So, but yeah, that was Oakley, and that's a legitimate story. Chris Childs told me that.
Yeah, there was a period of time where Charles Oakley would literally just show up to practices as a Raptor, the visitors' practice, and just smack people up because they owed him money. I think Tyrone Hill was a victim one time. I'm trying to think of other names. But yeah, no, and people should Google, by the way, Charles Oakley's thoughts on the Raptors purple dino jersey. His description of it, I literally cannot read any of the words on air, but if anybody wants to Google that, he did not have a great impression of the Raptors dino jersey. Listen, we're with Chris Herring, author of Blood in the Garden, the flagrant history of the 90s Knicks. So Chris, you good to stick around for the second segment? I still got lots to ask you about.
I'm good, man. Just let me know.
Let's do it. All right. I think it's a good spot for us to take a 5-minute break. I'm your host, Alex Wong. You're listening to the weekend edition of The Raptor Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Welcome back to the weekend edition of The Raptor Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. I'm your host, Alex Wong. I continue to be joined by Sports Illustrated senior writer and author of Blood in the Garden, The Flagrant History of the 1990s Knicks, Chris Herring. Chris, let's talk about the Raptors for a little.
Let's do it.
So what's your impression been? People in Toronto love getting an outsider basketball perspective on the Raptors. From what you've been able to watch of them this season, they're 22-21 on the season after wrapping up their 5-game road trip with a win in Washington last night. What have you seen so far, things that have stood out to you?
You know, honestly, it's funny. I remember joining Zach Lowe at the very beginning of the season, and we kind of were, I think we had an exercise where we had to pick either 4 teams or 5 teams that we were either much lower on or much higher on than everybody else. And I think we only ended up getting to 4 because of time. And my 5th team was the Raptors, that I thought would be a lot better than kind of where people had them pegged. You had people that had them as low as 12th. And it was kind of like, there's no way they're going to finish that low unless they're just not healthy at all. It was really easy to see how this team would make a jump. So it's not surprising to me, but it's good to see. And it's scary to see, quite frankly. And you think of someone like Fred VanVleet, who has been improving for years and, you know, has obviously been a solid player for years. But it's a little bit scary to see Kyle Lowry go somewhere else and for Fred to just kind of pick up so much of the slack. I don't even know if you could call it picking up slack, because Kyle didn't score like this. And so it's been wonderful to see that from him, and clearly an all-star this year, in my opinion. It's been good to see Pascal Siakam be healthy again. And, you know, I think even for myself, I maybe was a little bit guilty of having been too tough on him last year when he clearly was not. And so that part of it has been good to see, but it's also been kind of scary to see just Nick Nurse and Masai Ujiri just kind of unleash these lineups where everybody's 6'8". And, you know, there's just so much length on the court. And so it's been really, it's been kind of amazing to see all of that play out. It's been amazing to see them back at home. Granted, I know that the fans are not there right now because of the virus, kind of another, I guess you wouldn't even call it an uptick, but it's kind of what I expected. I kind of expected them to be right in the midst of the race, and I'm not surprised by it, but it's wonderful to see it after what happened last year.
Yeah, and Scotty Barnes, the rookie, had a career high in points last night in the win over Washington. And he's drawn rave reviews across the league from star players like Kevin Durant, and even Bradley Beal last night after the game said that Scotty's going to be a special player. Watching Scotty so far this season, what are things that have stood out to you?
Obviously it's the length, but I think it's also kind of the idea of being a little bit surprised that he, you know, the things that he was criticized for, like, oh, he might not really be much of a shooter. It might take a while for some of his offensive game to come around. He knew he was going to be impactful defensively. I don't know that people saw him as being a true factor in rookie of the year race. I mean, quite frankly, and I'm not someone that watches a whole lot of college basketball. I feel like, and you might be like this too, where there's so much responsibility to just watch the NBA during the season. It's kind of a heavy lift to try to do that and watch a lot of college basketball. Some people do it. I don't know how the hell they do. But, the offense has been a lot better and a lot more impactful than I think most people saw it being. I think a lot of people figured that Jalen Suggs would maybe go sooner in the draft than he did. And it's like, wow, Toronto definitely made the right pick there, at least for right now. I think we can say that between Suggs' injury and just how inefficient he's been offensively. But, he's been – solid. And I mean, there are moments where, especially before Fred hit this stretch and, Siakam was kind of back at full strength, that there were moments where Scottie Barnes looks like the most talented guy on the floor, which again, with rookies, you don't normally see that, but you can absolutely see the makings of something really special with him. And even when he's not playing particularly well, it's never because of effort. The guy just has an extremely high motor. And it's kind of what you've come to expect from Toronto with the length and with the athleticism and with, with the constant effort and just kind of being in the right spot at the right time. A really, really good pick for them and someone that fits their ethos perfectly.
This was my argument near the start of the season when the Raptors were below 500 that they should look into getting back into the lottery this season because they're so good at drafting. Like, they're so good at drafting when they have the 40th pick. They're even better when you give them like a lottery pick, like the number four pick. But, as we stand now we've crossed the midseason mark in terms of games played, the Raptors are honestly, too good to bottom out, but obviously not good enough to win a championship. So they're in a spot this season where it is a development season, but they find themselves in the playoff mix, either in the play-in, which they're in a play-in spot right now, and on the fringe of competing for potentially a top six spot. Where do you stand on when teams are on that kind of this development curve and this is where the Raptors are right now? Do you feel like, playing a couple play-in games or even getting a round, first round, seven-game series, playoff experience, do you think that bodes well for a team like this, especially it's got a mix of players who have playoff experience and a lot of young players who don't?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. I think it depends on a couple things or can depend on a couple things. Realistically, how far do you think the team can get? Which, we've seen a couple times the last few years now where you get teams that maybe don't look the part of being a contender right away that do make a deep run. We saw the Heat a couple years ago. What were they, a 5 seed, a 6 seed? And the bubble. Now, that was the bubble, so I know that was a little bit different. But, there was a couple years ago where that Kyrie Celtics team, Kyrie wasn't even playing, and they almost made it to the finals. And so you have some weird ones sometimes where, I think you don't want to sell a situation too short, but I think for the Raptors, what you have to probably be thinking about if you're Masai, and I'm sure he is what's the greater likelihood that we end up in the lottery and we get, I pick up on a guy that I really want, that I think maybe we can get in a certain spot and really develop and build a star that way. Or is it more likely to get someone through free agency that really moves the needle for you? Which, generally speaking, Toronto is not a place that you normally get a whole lot of star-level guys to come sign as a free agent, which is why the Kawhi thing was so beneficial for them, is that they were able to get a trade. They took a risk, obviously, and someone that might not stay there. But in that risk, they won a title. So, it depends on exactly what you're thinking. Like, what's the likelihood of you advancing? And I think if you can make it past the first round and you feel like you can get out of the first round, then maybe it's worth kind of taking a gamble and just going for it, to go for a little bit more this season. But really, in my humble opinion, I think with where they're at right now, it may not really be worth pushing in either direction. You're certainly not going to tell a team with a couple guys that are basically like all-star level players to not, you know, you wouldn't tell your players anyway not to try or to not really make the effort, you know, but I don't think you're going to sit those guys to try to end up lower in the standings. But I don't think you're going to push really hard and start trading actual assets that you have to try to get something else to make it happen right now. I don't, you know, I think they're in a good spot where whatever happens, there wasn't that much expected of them this season. But if they end up in the lottery because of that, that, you know, you always have faith in their ability to draft and develop. And that's the beauty of this organization.
Yeah, for sure. Last Raptors thing for you. I don't know if you saw Gary Trent Jr. last week in a game in Milwaukee. He didn't play and he wore this Gucci mohair cardigan on the bench with no shirt underneath. It was a huge fashion statement. Chris, I want to know, what is the most daring fashion statement you've ever tried to make?
That I've ever tried to make? When I got out of college, I went through a fedora phase. And I guess I'm not with the girlfriend anymore who was like, if you ever wear that again, I'm leaving you. But I mean, that should tell you all you need to know about that phase and how short-lived it was and how short-lived it needed to be based on what she told me. So
I love that, man. You ever look at photos of yourself from like 10, 20 years ago and just be like, what was I doing? Because I do that all the time.
Yes, I do, unfortunately.
And I can't wait to do that for a present day as well in 10 years. So back to your book, Chris, Blood in the Garden, the Flagrant History of the 1990s Knicks. I was wondering, too, because I went through the same process for cover story, what you had in mind as an initial book proposal and what you wanted to do with this book, how did that differ from the final product that ended up coming out, if at all?
Yeah, it wasn't very good, in my opinion. Like, it's funny. I've had some people who ask, like, can you show me your proposal so that I can get a sense of how this looks, how this works? I'm like, I can, but it's really not good. And the reality is, you know, the literary agent who gave me the idea to do it and suggested that I do it, wanted me to do it, was like, just write something, you know. And so it basically, remember what I was saying earlier, you never want your book to be something that all the fans know already. You want to be, you know, every page they're learning a lot of stuff and getting all these revelations. With what I did for the proposal, you're not, you know, some people do. I did not do a ton of reporting for my proposal. So because of that, you end up cobbling together like a lot of stories that have already been written. And you're just trying to stitch the stuff together to make it seem like it's original, but it's not. And, you know, it's interesting because now even just in talking to people from the past week, like the lead publisher, the person that runs the publishing house that published my book, they were like, we got to get you started on the second book now. And my editor was basically saying, like, you know, I think you've done enough in this first week, just, you know, the way the book is moving and the way people are responding to it, there's going to be opportunities for you in the future. And it's funny because, you know, I have complained so much about how I should have taken more time to do my proposal the first time and really put some reporting into it and make it better. And my editor was like, I don't think you're going to really need to worry about that the next time, because I think now your book will speak for itself and the reporting will speak for itself. But the proposal was, I mean, I think it was, there was effort in it. It just wasn't reported. And I think similar to you, I know you would know this from having read cover story, that if you turn that in just based on, like, without doing any reporting and just talking about the covers that you like and why you think they're interesting, my proposal read more like an essay than it did a story or something that was reported out. And there's always a massive difference between something that has, like, deep dive information that's never been out there because you reported it versus stuff that you can kind of find on the internet somewhere and maybe dress it up a little bit to make it seem a little bit more interesting. Like that, some people have more talent to kind of make something seem more interesting from the way they frame it or write it, but it's not the same as having completely detailed original information where you're talking to firsthand sources and it's the first time they've been asked a question. You're always going to get better information that way. So the proposal looks a lot different and a lot weaker than what the final product was ultimately.
Yeah, I think that last point is so interesting because going through cover story, and now I'm working on a book about the first year of the Raptors, which I think from a format standpoint probably lines up more similarly to your book, Blood in the Garden. And one of the things that I realize is, like, maybe the fact that I'm doing all these interviews and reaching out and getting these anecdotes from people is kind of like I'm compensating for the fact that I'd rather just have them tell the stories because I don't find my own kind of take on things to be as interesting. You know what I mean? Like, I know that's a very extreme way of looking at it, but in a way it's like you mentioned, it's like some writers have this great talent of being able to paint these scenes just from like the smallest detail. And I'm like, no. Let me call up these 15 people and let them paint the scene for me.
I hear what you're saying, but again, having read yours, I don't agree with you. I mean, it's one thing to let them tell enough of the story through quotes, but I still think, you know, a big part of the book, and this is one of the things that Spike said when he was talking to me and, you know, other people have been mentioning, or at least asking me about when I do podcasts with them, is like, the way you structured this thing is just so skillful, and you could tell there was purpose behind it. Like, there's a reason you put this here, and there's a reason you put this here. And I read yours and felt the exact same way. So don't sell yourself short, buddy. Like, it was a great read, and it's one thing to let people tell their stories, but there's a time and a place for telling the story and where you put it and where you place it and how it's structured that comes across really well when you've got a really good storyteller, and you're one of the best. So please don't sell yourself short in that regard.
All right, producer Derek, clip all that, man. I'm going to be playing that on next week's show for Will. I want Will to hear all that and respect me a little. No, I appreciate that. No, I think it's such an interesting balance, and I could talk to you about book writing all day, but, you know, back to the Knicks a little bit, and I love this Forrest Gump analogy that you made early in your book. You said, quote, they were a brute force version of Forrest Gump, repeatedly intertwined with historic moments. And I thought that was such a poignant description of the 90s Knicks, because having grown up watching that team, I mean, they were one of the handful of teams that you just remember from the 90s. They went head to head with Michael Jordan and the Bulls. Reggie Miller and the Pacers became their nemesis. And like we briefly touched on in the first segment, Pat Riley went to the Miami Heat, and that sparked a rivalry between those two teams. It was so interesting thinking about the different rivalries that the Knicks had, because at certain points, they did have the upper hand on the Bulls, on the Pacers, on the Heat. And of course, none of those seasons ended up in an NBA championship. I'm wondering, when you look at those three main rivalries that the 90s Knicks had, Chicago, Indiana, Miami, is there a way you can like categorize or even rank them in your own personal opinion?
In terms of how fiery the rivalries were, in terms of,
yeah,
like,
or even if I were to sit down and just ask you, like, which one was your favorite, like in terms of just the storylines and the things that played out?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. Yes, I don't know that I have an opinion, but it's like, I did ask for, you know, the people that covered the league at the time, like Jackie McMullen, for instance, you know, someone that has written entire books about the Celtics late rivalries during the 80s. Her opinion, you know, someone that was a prominent reporter in the 80s, the 90s, you know, the national media. And I asked her, I was like, curious, because of the ones you covered, the rivalries you covered, where to you does like Knicks Heat rank? Not necessarily rank, but like, what do you feel about that rivalry? She's like, that doesn't even register for me, because like championships weren't on the line, which is really interesting, because if you ask Knicks and Heat fans, like, what they think, like, they hate each other still. Riley is still in Miami now. And, you know, Knicks fans feel like he was stolen. And he was, more or less. But it's interesting, because I don't think to the average NBA person, Heat-Knicks really registers for exactly the reason Jackie said. But I also don't think that you can deny that it was probably the most fiery rivalry of the late 90s. Like, they hated each other. I mean, there's a quote in the book, not that I got it originally, but, you know, that Tim Hardaway had said, he essentially said, is it possible to hate anybody more? Like, what's the most you could possibly hate somebody or something? He's like, well, I hate the Knicks more than I hate the most that you could possibly hate anything else. Like, he was basically just saying that, you know, the teams were built exactly the same way. Riley had left the Knicks. He built the Heat to be exactly like the Knicks. He hired Stan Van Gundy because he couldn't bring Jeff with them and wanted to still have a Van Gundy on his staff. It was a bizarre rivalry, but they also, it wasn't just like the backstory. It was the fact that they played against each other in the playoffs 4 years in a row. All four of those series went the distance and went the maximum number of games they could go. You know, there were upsets involved. The Knicks beat them as an 8 seed when the Heat were number 1 seed. And the Knicks made the finals that year. There were fights involved in two of the series and major suspensions in two of the series that shifted the series. David Stern had to like mediate stuff between Jeff Van Gundy and Pat Riley because of how nasty the tone of it had gotten, where basically Larry Johnson and Alonzo Mourning swung at each other and they missed each other a couple times on their punches. And Riley's like, my only regret about that happening is that Alonzo's punches didn't connect. Like, that is a wild thing to say. And this was just what the NBA was in the 90s, really. So, that was a very fiery rivalry. I just don't know that people recognize it because it meant more to you. You know, I went to Michigan, so it's like it means more to me when Michigan or Ohio State play than the average person. And when Michigan doesn't win that game for 10 years, of course people are going to care about tied to Michigan or Ohio State. So I just kind of feel like since that was not for a championship every year, people kind of forget. But there was that. And then I think for most people, it was probably Michael and the Knicks that mattered most. But, you know, I actually think that Reggie Miller, at least Michael was dominating everybody during those years. Reggie felt more personal to the Knicks fans. So I feel like Knicks fans hated Reggie Miller the most. They respected Michael and feared him a little bit and really wanted to beat him the most. But I feel like the Miami thing ran deepest just because it was Riley on the other side. So it's like, I don't know if there's one answer for that. You probably have to ask a fan exactly how they feel about it, but I feel like they all mattered a whole lot. And two of those teams were beatable and one of them was not, you know, almost got Michael, but they never did. So that part of it, I feel like people still remember the Michael stuff most just because he was at the forefront of everything in that era.
Yeah, no, I love reading the book and learning so much more behind the scenes details that went into those three rivalries. Like I mentioned, you know, when I think about the Knicks, I think about those series. I think about John Starks dunking over the Bulls. I think about Reggie Miller scoring those 8 points in 9 seconds. And then, you know, Jeff Van Gundy hanging on to whoever's leg it was when the Knicks broke out. So I thought that Forrest Gump description was so perfect. And if people want to either relive those memories or learn about the 90s, because it did strike me the other day when I saw a tweet that told me that 1992 was 30 years ago. I've never actually felt older than when I read that tweet. I'm sorry to hit you with that, Chris, to start your weekend. But yeah, no, there's so much to learn in this book, I think, whether you grew up watching 90s basketball or not. So make sure you go pick up a copy, available now online in stores, Blood in the Garden, The Flagrant History of the 1990s Knicks. Chris Herring, thank you so much for making the time, and congratulations again, and best of luck with the rest of your book interviews.
Thank you so much, buddy. I really appreciate you, and you be well. And be proud of your book. I don't want to hear anything about this. Let other people tell their stories. Let
Chris,
them tell it.
Chris,
structure that
Chris,
crap the way you want to, man.
Chris, you don't know me. I was just fishing for compliments, and you came through for me, so I appreciate you. No, Chris, how about...
I'm so mad. Take care, man. Thank you so much.
No, I really do appreciate it. Thank you, Chris. So that does it for us for today. You've been listening to the weekend edition of The Raptor Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. I've been your host, Alex Wong. Make sure you subscribe to The Raptor Show wherever you get your podcasts, and please rate and review our show. Keep us the number one ranked basketball podcast in Canada. We're live on air Monday to Friday at 2 p.m. and Saturdays at noon. Thanks again to my guest Chris Herring and to my producers JR and Derek for helping with the show today, and I'll talk to you soon.